session number 4291, reel 1.
Brigadier Good, Reel 1. What was your family background, sir?
Well, I was born in 1908. My father was in the Royal Artillery. And immediately after I was born, he was posted to South Africa. And I went out there with them. I don't remember much about anything about it, really. But we came back in, I think it was about 1910. And I went to a small school near the station where he was stationed, which was in Berkshire. And from there, I went to a school called Borden Grammar School in Sittingbourne. And from there, I won a scholarship to Reading University. I won a scholarship, and I went to King's College London to start with. And I took the intermediate BSc at King's College, and then I went on to Reading, where I took the final BSc 2 years later. I was then only 19, and so I'd always wanted to go into the army. That was my full intention always, and so I had to wait till I was 21, being a university candidate. And so I took a job as a teacher for a year, and then joined. I was going into the Royal Artillery, but I was playing tennis against the Royal Army Service Corps for the university, and after one of the matches, an old brigadier, I can't remember his name now, asked me what I was going to do when I left the university. I said I was going into the gunners. He said, "Oh, you come and have lunch in Aldershot with me next week." So I went over to Aldershot to Buller Barracks. And about 11 o'clock in the morning, they were all drinking gin, and they were in hunting kit and tennis kit. I thought, this is the life for me, and so I joined the Royal Army Service Corps, much to my father's disgust, but still. Having joined the Corps, I started on my initial training, which was learning how to drill, of course, because I hadn't been to Sandhurst, learning how to ride. We were in the stables at 5:30 every morning for 2 hours, learning to ride. We had lectures during the day. Then, at the end of a year, I went to Guy Motors in Wolverhampton for training as a motor engineer. When I'd done that, I took the AMI Mackie examination, which I managed to pass. And I then went back to Aldershot for a year in one of our supply companies. And it was there at the end of 1934 that I was told that the Director of Supplies and Transport wanted to see me in the War Office. So with some trepidation, I donned my bowler hat and went up to see the director. And he said, "How would you like to go to the Sudan, Good?" And I'd never heard of the Sudan. I didn't know where it was or anything, but I said, "Yes, sir, I'd go like a shot." And I left for the Sudan on the 2nd of May, 1935.
Why were you so ready to go?
Well, I mean, the whole point of joining the army was to see the world, and I was tired of being orderly officer in Aldershot. Although the life there was very good, but the idea of going abroad, of course, was very exciting. I had to have a very strict medical examination before they accepted me. That was done by the Crown agents. And having passed that, I then sailed for the Sudan. Now, one of the rules of the Sudan government was that any official, it didn't matter whether you were in the army or in the civil service, on your first on your way out the first time, if you wanted to buy polo ponies, you could stop in Cairo to buy them for a week. Of course, we were on full pay from the day we sailed. So my father was stationed in Heliopolis at that time, and so I spent 7 days in Cairo buying polo ponies. I didn't buy any, but I did have a good week's holiday there. And then I sailed down the Nile to Khartoum, or at least down to Wadi Halfa, and from Wadi Halfa by train to Khartoum. On my arrival, my commanding officer, Colonel Henfrey, whom I'd never met before, but I'd heard of him, explained to me that in the Sudan you had 9 months on duty and then 3 months leave every year. And so we couldn't both go together, because there were only two of us, he and I. So he said he was going on late leave in 1935, so I would have to go on early leave. So after about 5 days, I returned to England on leave, much to the amazement of all my friends who thought I'd disappeared into Central Africa.
Where did you buy your kit, in England or in the Sudan?
No, I had a letter from Beau Henfrey, that was Colonel Henfrey, my CO, telling me not to buy anything except boots, riding boots, if I hadn't got any. Well, in those days, the Royal Army Service Corps wore boots and leggings. So the only thing I really bought in the way of uniform was a pair of boots. He said that all my uniform could be made in Khartoum. And so when I arrived, I did the first time I went, within 2 days I'd had all my uniform made, shorts and bush shirts and helmets, and that was it.
Where was it made?
In Khartoum, in a shop called Vanyan's. I always remember it very well. I think they were Greeks. May have been Greeks, yes, I think they were, but they were amazing. Within 24 hours it was all finished, and beautifully done too, and very cheap, of course.
What was your pay like in the Sudan Defence Force?
Well, of course, that was terrific. It was about, I think it was about 2,000 a year, with no tax, no income tax. Everything, of course, was very cheap. Whiskey was half a crown a bottle. Everything was terribly cheap, and living was cheap. I, being a bachelor, I lived in the club, in the Sudan club, so there was no difficulty about that. And I lived there for about 18 months before I got married.
Well, what sort of accommodation did you have when you were married?
Well, we were married. My wife was also in the Sudan government service as a nurse, and we were married in June 1937 in the Khartoum Cathedral at 7:30 in the morning.
Why so early?
Well, you do everything out there in the early, before it gets too hot, and we were on the 8 o'clock train for Cairo. We caught the 8 o'clock train and spent our honeymoon in Alexandria and Paris and Venice and various places, and the rest of it at home in England and Scotland. My wife lives in Berwick-on-Tweed, lived in Berwick-on-Tweed. After our 3 months leave, we went back, and I'd been posted to El Obeid, which is about 500 miles south west of Khartoum. We had there a very nice little house, furnished, because we bought the furniture from the officer I took over from,
Was that usual?
Yes, that happened all the time out there. No one ever moved their furniture out of the country. They just sold it to the next person coming in. And we lived in El Obeid for a year, and then I was posted to Khartoum.
Did you have servants?
Yes. As a bachelor, I had they call them suffragi. He did nothing else but look after me. Of course, he didn't have to cook or do my run the house at all, because I lived in the club. But he looked after me, and I had a little monkey which he also looked after. But when we were married, of course, in El Obeid, we had a suffragi, that's a sort of head man, a cook, a assistant cook, a sais to look after. We had a couple of horses, sais who looked after the horses and also looked after our animals. We had all sorts of animals. We had a leopard, an ostrich, chickens, ducks, guinea fowl. That was his job.
Where did you keep the leopard?
Oh, it just ran around. It was only a baby one. You can keep them for about 2 years, and then they go, then they run away, or they get savage. 2 years is the limit you can keep those sort of things.
Again, was that usual, or were you unusual in having a leopard?
Well, no, quite a few people had a lion or a cheetah or a leopard. The cheetah was the best one of the lot. It's just like a big cat, but even that wouldn't stay after 2 years.
And did you keep the same servants all the time, or was there a turnover?
We kept the same servants while we were in El Obeid, but we kept the servants in Khartoum. Not altogether, no. We did have to change those a little. They were rather different people, more sophisticated in Khartoum, but on the whole, we kept the same people most of the 3 or 4 years we were there.
And what sort of food did you eat?
Well, we lived. The food was absolutely excellent. The cook had a little cookhouse in the garden where he cooked on wood. It was amazing the meals they produced. But we had fish for breakfast and bacon and eggs, full proper English breakfast every day. That, of course, was about 6 o'clock in the morning, because we always started work at 6:30. The food was good all the time. Even on trek, the cook produced full meals, and ice and drinks and everything every evening. We lived very well indeed.
Did your wife ever have to teach your cook certain tips?
No, I don't think so, no.
What sort of social life did you have in Khartoum?
Well, of course, it was a wonderful social life. Our day we worked from up till 2 o'clock, and then we had lunch, came home and had lunch. Then we went to bed from 2:30 till 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock we dressed for some sport, either tennis or rowing, or sailing, or riding, anything we wanted to do, squash, and went down to the club until 6 o'clock, when it got dark. And it got dark suddenly. So home again to a bath, and then the rest of the evening I either had friends to play bridge and have dinner, or go to the club to play bridge and have dinner. And that was it.
Did you have much contact with the Sudan political force when you were there?
Well, of course, we mixed with them a lot in the club, because and in our work we occasionally had to do them, because one of our jobs in the mechanical transport department was to look after the civil vehicles. We looked after those, maintained them. And so we had quite a lot to do with them, really, and especially in El Obeid, where we were only 20 British people, and so it was one big family, really.
Did you have much contact socially with the Sudanese officers?
No, very little. Very little. It was a great honour. We used to ask the two senior officers once a year to tea at our house, and they considered it a great honour. Other than that, we never had any contact with them socially. They went off to their little house in Khartoum North at the end of the work, and that was that.
And what about contact with British NCOs?
Yes, well, we had in the mechanical transport, we had about six warrant officers, British warrant officers, who were seconded, of course, to the Sudan Defence Force. And in a place like El Obeid, they were treated just like an officer. They were a member of the club, and we played bridge with them. And they were very nice people, especially Picts, you see. And they all got commissions afterwards. And during the war, some of them became colonels. They were hand-picked people.
Was there much contact with a British foreign battalion that would be stationed at Khartoum?
Yes, there was always there were always two battalions, British battalions in Khartoum, one in Khartoum North and one in Khartoum South, and of course they belonged to our club as well, so we met there. We used to go to some of their functions, their sports days and that sort of thing. But on the whole, I would say that we didn't mix with them an awful lot, really.
What about health hazards in the Sudan? How were these?
Well, in the north, there weren't very many hazards, really. There was very little malaria in the north, but of course in the south, in the Equatorial Corps, it was pretty grim, and people did get sick down there. But we had nothing the matter with us until the last month we were there, and then my wife and I both got malaria. But other than that, I don't remember any trouble at all.
Did you ever suffer from the heat itself?
No, the heat. It's really quite unbelievable, because it was about 130 in the shade in the summer for 9 months of the year, but we never felt it at all. It was so dry, you see. The humidity was nil. And we used to play squash and tennis in it and think nothing of it.
What sort of Christian presence was there in the Sudan?
Of course there was a very strong Christian presence, because there was a bishop of the Sudan, Bishop Gwyn, when we were there, who was a very famous character. And there was in Khartoum itself, there was the cathedral and and a dear old parson called, I've forgotten his name now, but he used to have us all to tea in his rectory, and the children, he ran a school for the British children, and we all went to the cathedral every Sunday morning, yes. And there was a very strong Christian, and we still support the cathedral in Khartoum. We still have a day every year in London where we have a bring and buy sale, and the proceeds go to the Khartoum Cathedral. Oh yes, and in El Obeid we had a lovely little thatched church, which the 20 of us used to attend on Sunday evenings. I used to play the organ for that. Shows what wasn't a very big affair.
Were there many Christian Sudanese?
Yes, quite a lot, really. In the churches, there are probably far more Sudanese than British, really, especially in El Obeid. The church was packed with them. And there were missionaries all over the country, you see.
What sort of contact would you have officially with the missionaries?
Nothing officially, no. We just met them when we visited the places they happened to be. We would probably have dinner with them or be invited to tea or something, but officially we didn't have much to do with them. We may have, I think we used to help them a bit with their vehicles if they were in trouble, but You see, it was one big family. It didn't matter whether you were a district commissioner or a judge or a soldier or anything else. It was one big happy family, all out to help each other and help the Sudanese.
Could I turn now to your duties over the period?
Yes.
In your first year in Khartoum, you were in mechanical transport. But what did this involve for you?
Well, Khartoum was the sort of headquarters of the mechanical transport department, and we had a very big workshop there where we looked after our own vehicles, which we did have a training company there for training people how to drive, so those vehicles needed looking after. We used to purchase vehicles not only for the Sudan Defence Force but for the Sudan government, and we looked after the vehicles of the Sudan government. There weren't very many of those. So our job really was the training of our own soldiers in mechanical transport duties and supply duties, although the supplies wasn't very strong really, because they didn't draw rations except on manoeuvres. Mm. And even then we used to give them the money and they went off and bought their rations. So the main job was the workshops, looking after the mechanical side of the vehicles and training of drivers.
How long did it take to train a driver?
About a month, I would say, from the time he arrived. But we were not only training them as drivers, of course, we were training them as soldiers as well.
So the complete process would take how long?
I think they used to be with us for about 3 months. And then they were fully qualified to drive and trained as a soldier to shoot and so on.
Do you know if they earned more than ordinary soldiers by virtue of being able to drive?
Yes, I think they did have a little increment. It wasn't, of course, their total pay wasn't very much. I don't suppose that was more than about 10 piastres a day, which was 2 shillings. And I think they did get a few piastres for being a qualified driver.
Were they recruited from the Khartoum townspeople, or were they just from anywhere in the Sudan?
Well, no, they all came from the northern of Sudan, and we always found certain tribes went for certain parts of the army, and I think most of our chaps were I've forgotten the name of the tribe now, Shagulis, or can't remember the name, but they. Different tribes look different, and all our soldiers rather look the same, with the same marks on their cheeks. So they seem to come from the same tribe. And when we were at El Obeid, the people there came from a different tribe, but they all seem to come from the same one.
Did you train the civilian chauffeurs as well?
No, we didn't, no. Mm. No.
We don't know how they got their training.
No, there couldn't have been more than two or three anyway, and they'd probably been in the job for donkey's years, most of them. Mm. Don't remember what happened there.
What sort of vehicles were you using in your first year there?
They were all Fords, and they came straight from America and straight to the workshop where they were fitted up for the Sudan. That means that large tyres, sand tyres they were called, which were very big tyres to get through the sand, and we used to have to fit a bigger fan and sometimes a bigger radiator. They had to be adapted for the climate. And then during the war, or before the war, we adapted them to be motor machine gun vehicles. We had to strengthen the chassis put a bit of armour on them, and that was all done in our workshops.
Mm. And in El Obeid, where you served for a year after this, you commanded mechanical transport unit here.
Yes, there was a workshop and not a company really, just a few vehicles and drivers in El Obeid. The workshop was really run by a warrant officer, and Then we had another workshop in Fasher, which was about 450 miles west, which was run by an NCO. He looked after the vehicles of the Western. We looked after the vehicles of the Camel Corps in El Obeid, and the Fasher workshop looked after the vehicles of the Western Arab Corps, and of course the civilian, the district commissioner, the governor, and all those other vehicles. And so I used to have to go up to Fasher once every 3 months, which meant being away about 10 days, because it was a three-day journey to get there, a three-day back and two or three days there. My wife used to come with me on those trips, together with all the servants and all the food and drink. We used to shoot on the way for meat, and it was very pleasant, really.
Could you elaborate a little on the duties of the British NCOs that you came in contact with during this year?
I only had one NCO, and he really was off. He was really looking at. He commanded it really in a way. The workshop in lieu of an officer. And his job was to make sure that the workshop functioned properly and the jobs were done on vehicles and spare parts ordered, and he did all that. In fact, he was more like an officer, really, than an NCO.
Would he have had other duties which were more usually those of an officer? Or was his officer-like duties restricted to the workshop?
Oh, no, only the workshop, yes. Yes. That was his domain, looking after the workshops.
Did you have any problems in the transitional period in which I think you were in, converting from use of camels to mechanical transport?
No, not at all. In fact, it had gone quite a long way before I got to El Obeid. There were still camels there, but a lot of them had gone, and they'd been replaced by these little motor machine gun vehicles that we manufactured in Khartoum. And the old camel disappeared after a few months.
Were there any regrets?
I don't think so, really.
Nobody was nostalgic.
No, I don't. I never came across anybody being upset about losing the camels.
Not even the Sudanese.
Don't think so. No.
Or come to that, the British officers who knew them.
No, I don't think so. No.
What exercises were you doing at this time with mechanical transport?
Well, apart from training drivers in El Obeid, the whole of the Sudan Defence Force used to go out on an exercise once a year, different parts of the Sudan. Of course, we only had about three while I was there because the war came, and that was an exercise of its own. The whole of the Sudan Defence Force used to collect together. I remember the first one was at Fasher, another one was at El Obeid, and I forget where I think the other one may have been in the eastern, in Gadarif area. And we carried out an exercise rather like the British you do on Salisbury Plain,